And in my work, which is a field of developmental psychopathology, so I'm really interested in looking at the intersection of normal and abnormal behavior. And part of that work is trying to understand what are some of the mechanisms or processes that affect adolescents or, you know, children for that matter. And so I'm more concerned about what are the different processes, the different steps that lead to certain outcomes. And so in that regard, when we call it a process-oriented model, is that we were trying to understand what are some of the things that are going to affect, in this case, adolescents' psychological functioning. So we know that there has been shown a direct effect between school start times and adolescents' psychological functioning. But what are some of the processes? You know, what are some of the things that are going to lead us to understanding, you know, what is how their psychological functioning is affected? And so what we did with this particular study is we were interested in understanding what teenagers do in terms of the process of getting themselves ready for bed and preparing for a good night's sleep, whether or not they're getting a good night's sleep, and ultimately how that is potentially impacting their psychological functioning. So that's sort of a model that we looked at. And then we looked at that model in the context of whether or not you're a student who wakes up who goes to an early starting school or basically anything before 8:30 a.m. Or a school we call later starting schools, 8:30 a.m. or after. And that magic number 8:30 is comes from the American Academy of Pediatricians, which a few years ago set a school start times or as a policy initiative that they should start at 8:30 to allow students to adolescent students to get a better night's sleep, longer night's sleep. And just the biological underpinnings of that are really that in adolescence, you know, when a student hits puberty, they shift in terms of their circadian rhythm, and so they actually want to go to bed later, want to wake up later, through no fault of their own, simply through biology. And that has, sometimes we wonder, you know, why are teenagers sleeping so late? Why don't they get to bed earlier? Well, part of it is just simply biology. And unfortunately, the environment, or in this case, school start times, comes into direct conflict with their biology.
Mm-hmm.
So our interest in this study was understanding that, this model of if a student can, adolescent age student can get themselves ready for bed in a good place before bed and get better quality sleep, and that's going to, you know, have hypothesize a positive influence on their psychological functioning, does that process differ for if you're, you know, waking up or an early starting school or a later starting school? So that, in a nutshell, is sort of what led us to do what we did.
So after you analyze all of these data, give us a thumbnail sketch of your results and the findings that you came up with.
Yeah, so in terms of the data, I mean, what we were looking for is we measured specifically their sleep hygiene. So we looked at adolescents, filled out a lengthy questionnaire about how they prepared themselves to go to bed and whatnot. So that was one piece. And then what we did is we took, we also asked them about their, what we call circadian chronotype, which is basically their, whether or not they are more prone to be morning people or evening people. And so in addition to that, we also looked at, from the sleep diaries, we took their average in terms of how well they were sleeping across the week, how their average daily levels of depression and anxiety symptoms, as well as their average daily sleep duration. So if we think a little bit about, where these things fell, well, what we found is that sleep quality was associated with their sleep hygiene. So for in the most part, those who slept better had better sleep hygiene. Also, those who had better sleep hygiene, so who took more care and had a better routine going to bed, and who, we can talk more about sleep hygiene if you'd like, but certainly who had better sleep hygiene, those people tended to have, those students tended to have fewer depressive and anxiety symptoms. In terms of just simply the school start times, in our sample, for those students who had a later school start time, that average was around 8:45 a.m. And those students who had a earlier school start, the average was around 7:45 a.m. So, what we found is that the students who were getting had the later school start time were actually getting almost an hour more of sleep a day, which is considerable and really important in terms of thinking about the effects. So those were some of the effects. I mean, across the study, it was about split, even male and female. With that said, I think because of the nature of the sample, it was slightly more higher socioeconomic status and more Caucasian participants than we would see across the population.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at results from three other studies that looked at school start times. A study done by Finley Edwards at Colby College, the headline, if you will, in Education Next News, school start times found to affect student achievement. By changing the start time from 7:30 to 8:30 would increase standardized math and reading scores by 2 to 3 percentile points. And this was a study done in Wake County, North Carolina. Another study done by Andrew Kogan and Neil McGowan, ADHD, attention deficit and hyperactivity disorders, and talks about the effects of the circadian clock in ADHD and school start times. And then finally, and as a school board member, I mean, all these are important, and as you know, and certainly your study as well, but this one, shifting school start times could contribute $83 billion to U.S. economy, and on an annual basis, $9.3 billion each year, which is roughly the annual revenue of Major League Baseball. And these economic gains projected through the study's model would be realized through the higher academic and professional performance of students and reduced car crashes among adolescents, as well as a change in transportation costs in school districts and bus routes, et cetera, et cetera. So my question for you, Jack, is with your study and all the other studies that have been done, and I looked at your CV, your resume, with all the research that you have done, here's the quintessential question I have for you as a researcher, as an educator, as a professor. Why is it that so many people always like to talk about all this wonderful research that's out there, and yet no one really listens to it and pays attention to it and says, hey, let's actually start changing the school start times, or let's start reducing classroom, the number of students in a class, because there's research out there that says that the number of students in a class when compared to large class sizes and small class sizes has an impact on achievement and the climate in the classroom. Why is it that people don't pay attention to the research?
First of all, that's a great question. Second of all, I wish I had the quintessential answer for you. I think there are a number of different factors. I think first is the, you mentioned the potential economic impact of, what these researchers found in terms of school start times on, society and whatnot. But at the same time, the nature of our findings I think there's a lot of inertia to that change, partially because of this belief that simply changing things, when are we going to see these? When are we going to see these economic changes? And so there's sort of a disbelief there. I think also, especially with school start times, there's so many different hands in the pie, or simply different systems that are operating. So everyone, in terms of school start times, you have the schools and the coaches and after school activity coordinators. You have parents and teachers and teacher unions who have concerns about when their employees or when their children, or as parents, when they're going to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, you have bus drivers and school transportation and all of those aspects in terms of. So specifically for school start times, there is, I think it's so many people involved in making a decision, making this potential changes that it falls a little bit. There's an inertia. There's perhaps a tragedy of the commons, who is sort of going to take charge. And ultimately, I think we fear, changes to what we think has worked so well in the past. I mean, that's not to say, obviously, research has informed us as a society and certainly changed our behavior. In this case, I will say that in the past decade, the increasing research on school start times is having an effect. And certainly our increased attention on sleep is having an effect. So I can speak to upstate New York and in the five or six school districts within a half-hour drive from my home, they are all of the superintendents are addressing this question. Now, when I say they're addressing this question, the first thing that they will say is, all of these forces are keeping us from changing them. And they'll mention mm-hmm. economic forces, they'll mention buses, whatnot. I wish that people, would understand more about the research. I'm really appreciative. I'm grateful of your work in terms of, bringing light to this study, but also to other studies around this issue. And ultimately, I think that, this work is going to, I think slowly, keep working its way into our consciousness. I think if we think of adolescence as our natural resource, and the future citizens of our country, that those that we have to, they are an incredible resource. If we don't take care of them, we are, in a sense, wasting or losing out on that. So, in terms of why we don't pay attention or do enough with research, I think there's also a piece around, a lot of the research done is correlational. And, for every time that we have a study that, makes a neat headline, there will be people saying, well, these are just correlations, they're associations, and, we can only put so much stock in them, and we can't, obviously, we need more randomized controlled experiments to prove something. And the research in psychology is, in any other science, sort of moves slowly, and we're very tentative in what we conclude because of simply that, that's the nature of the scientific process. There's so many different factors, especially in a system, like sleep, that could be operating that, we would never be one to say, if you do this with school start times, this is exactly what you will get.
Sure. So, Jack, I want to thank you so much for being my guest this morning on Education Matters. And if our listeners want to read more about your study, how might they get access to either the study or the article that is online?
The best way to get access to this study and to other studies about school start times The journal Sleep Health of the National Sleep Foundation actually had a special issue, of which our study is one of a number of studies about school start times. And so if they go to the Sleep Health Journal website and look at articles in print, there'll be my study with my co-authors, as well as about half a dozen other studies that specifically look at school start times. But that can all be found on the Sleep Health website.
And my guest in this first segment of Education Matters today has been Dr. Jack Peltz, who is a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and also assistant professor of psychological sciences at Damon College in Amherst, New York. And we continue now with Education Matters here on WGTDHD. And I'm very, very pleased to welcome as my guest in this segment, Mark Walsh. And Mark writes for Education Week, and his area of focus is school law. And Mark, welcome to Education Matters.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into some of the issues going on in Washington as far as with the U.S. Supreme Court and other legal issues, maybe if you could give our audience a sense of who Mark Walsh is, where you went to school, where you grew up, where you went to college, and how you got engaged and involved in the whole area of law as it pertains to education.
Well, I grew up in suburban Chicago. I'm, you know, Cubs fan, Bears fan, and I went to school at Northwestern University. I studied journalism and political science. I do not have a law degree. In the Supreme Court press room, among regulars who cover the Supreme Court, maybe a quarter of them do have law degrees, but most do not. And, you know, it's a political beat as well as a legal beat. And we can usually, you know, get access to some very bright legal minds to explain some of those difficult things. But I was at Education Week full-time for many years and began covering the Supreme Court in 1991. The spring of that year is when Thurgood Marshall retired,
yeah,
and when Clarence Thomas came on and obviously had quite a story with getting confirmed to the court. And with the exception of a few years where I was more of an editor, you know, I've been covering the court and education issues in the Supreme Court for all that time. I also covered the court a little more generally for a magazine called the ABA Journal, the American Bar Association's magazine. And again, I'm trying to explain for them, an audience of about 400,000 lawyers, some of the some of the big issues, and then contribute to a blog called SCOTUS Blog, which kind of covers the court up and down. And I usually am writing a column from the courtroom, especially in the spring when opinions are coming down, just because there are no cameras in the courtroom. And, you know, there may be well-known people in the courtroom, or, you know, like, well, a couple weeks ago we had Arnold Schwarzenegger in the courtroom for a case on redistricting, which is from Wisconsin, Switford.
And, yeah, that whole gerrymandering thing going on.
Yeah, partisan gerrymandering case. So, you know, so I'm looking for luminaries and sometimes some odd or ironic moments in the courtroom.
Why don't we drill down a little on a few topics in the time that we have? As everyone knows, here in the Kenosha area, there's the issue of transgender bathrooms and the case that's currently that will be heard by the court or on the transgender bathroom issue and Kenosha Unified. I know back in March, the headline of an article you wrote, education groups line up on different sides in transgender case. This was the Gloucester County School Board versus GG. Are you surprised at all that these cases are already at the U.S. Supreme Court level?
Well, not really, because I think it just evident, as it can be in any area of the law, that there's a lot going on in society on this issue and then in the lower courts. And so soon after the case from last term, which just to very quickly remind your audience is the audience that the court had decided to grant review of a case involving transgender bathroom rights in school, but that case was sort of freighted with issues of administrative law that I certainly won't go too far into, but questions about guidance by the Education Department.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really why it was a surprise that the Supreme Court took up that case last term, or said that it was going to take that up, but I think the court was concerned about some major issues being decided based on some guidance letters from fairly mid-level bureaucrats at the U.S. Department of Education.
I'm looking at your September 29th of this year, your Educator's Guide to the Supreme Court's 2017-18 term, and you talk about union fees, and of course, as you know, here in Wisconsin, we have Act 10 that sort of essentially didn't totally do away with teachers' unions, but certainly it impacted the role and power of unions. But the second item, the little subheading is CAKE, Same-sex marriage, religion, and speech, and this is about the masterpiece Cake Shop and the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And when I first saw that, the first thing that you mentioned was exactly what I was wondering, and you state, the case has implications for education. And maybe if you could just talk briefly, why and how would this case that deals with a private owner of a cake shop, a bakery, have anything to do with education? And of course, this case is against the cake shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission.
Okay, so it's a very good question you ask, and it's a question I'm still asking myself,
mm-hmm.
partly because any big case in the Supreme Court, I'm sort of looking for the education angle, partly because that's my job, and I'm looking for things to write about, and I've found some pretty strange angles over the years. But here, this is where a private owner of a bakery who specializes in wedding cakes and specialty cakes refused to serve or bake a cake for a same-sex couple's marriage celebration for their reception. And under Colorado law, that couple went to that state body that deals with those kinds of civil rights issues and has won. But the Supreme Court's going to take up the case of the baker. So what are the education implications? Well, it's not completely clear to me yet, but other than the fact that, in society in general, we're often talking about religious objections mm-hmm. to civil rights laws, and that's to some degree maybe a little bit more of an issue at the college level. It's not so much an issue with public schools.
Although they do reference the Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett going back to 1943 with the Pledge of Allegiance. So maybe that's their, that seems to be the thread that does tie it into public education, right?
Right. So as I'm looking for these angles, the baker, Jack Phillips, in this case, and his lawyers, they do assert that being forced to bake a cake that would celebrate same-sex marriage when Mr. Phillips has religious objections to that, as one might expect, would be the reason. That's a form of compelled speech, and then they're really most of their arguments are directed towards the First Amendment speech clause, over the free exercise of religion clause. And Jack Phillips cites, the 1943 case where the Supreme Court reversed itself from just a few years prior to that and said that students in public school may not be compelled to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. That's the Barnett case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As you look at other pending cases, maybe in the time that we have, which one or two cases do you see as the most prominent at this point that pertain to education?
Okay, so, you know, we've talked about a bunch of cases, and some of those are granted, and the Master Beast Cake Shop, and you briefly mentioned the union fees case, and that was just granted right before the formal start of the term. That's where the court is going to return to this issue of whether people who don't want to join their public employee union but still have to pay a service fee, for being represented by that union. That's, you know, the court deadlocked on that, heard it right before Justice Scalia died, and now it's basically in the hands of new Justice Neil Gorsuch, it looks like, when that is argued probably in January. So those are among the cases that the court is hearing. Among those that, you know, that really could make this a bigger term for education, we mentioned the transgender case from Kenosha. We don't need to go further on that, but another one that's I'm keeping a close eye on is one involving school board prayers, where the public school board opens its meeting with prayers. Just a few years ago, the court upheld prayers in by a municipal body, the town of Greece, New York, but the court did not, you know, make clear whether that would the same principles would apply at the school board level, and the lower courts have kind of grouped have kind of separated school boards apart from municipalities like county boards and city councils, or some have and some haven't, and so there really is kind of a split there. The question is, you know, school boards often have students around to be recognized, and the school board meetings held in schools, and is it the same thing? So that's one, and that's the court will decide at some point this fall probably whether to take up that case.
Yeah, and with that case, do you see as he has become sort of, people like to say, the conscience of the court, he sort of took Sandra Day O'Connor's place on the court now, the deciding voter on the court, and that's Justice Kennedy, the person who may very well be the deciding vote, or does that sort of fall into the category of one can never predict how a justice is going to vote?
I think this one would fall to Justice Kennedy, because I think based on other, you know, a variety of other things, including especially the Town of Greece case, where he was at the center of that case. You know, I think and then he wrote the opinion that said, you know, prayers can actually solemnize a public meeting, and, but he also has his concerns about compulsion on students that is evidenced in his decision going back to the early 90s in the graduation prayer case known as Lee versus Weissman. So that, you know, I would love to see that one get granted. There's some talk here in Washington, and certainly there was last spring, but he did not retire. There's some talk that Justice Kennedy may retire at the end of this term, and that would be a big deal, obviously.
Yeah, and, you know, and with that, do you really think that, many people think, rather, that whether it be Justice Kennedy or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that maybe they're just holding out and in their minds hoping that there will be a Democratic president in 3 years or less, and maybe hold out and as long as their health holds out.
That's certainly sort of the conventional wisdom now, and I think it's certainly true with Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, and maybe even they could hope for, from their perspectives, for the Senate to change in a little bit less than 2 years, and that might change the political dynamic. But And you know, and you say, I mean, justices tend to want to perhaps retire under the same administration under which they were appointed, but there are exceptions, you know,
sure,
to that. I mean, both Justice Stevens and Justice Souter retired in the first couple years of the Obama administration.
Right.
And both were appointed by Republican presidents.
Right.
But they were also on the left side of the
Sure. Court. Sure. And my last question for you, since you have been covering the court now since 1991, and now we have a new justice with Justice Gorsuch, I know there were a lot of analyses about how he might rule on issues on education, and there was a whole slew of cases, freedom of speech issues, you know, First Amendment issues. Just based on your own analyses of cases that he has looked at, and I'm not asking you, you know, to cite, you know, specific cases, where do you see Justice Gorsuch now in terms of the influence that he might have on the court that maybe we didn't know about before?
So, there was quite a bit there, you know, because he had served about 10 years, I think, on the Tenth Circuit. So quite a bit there for people to chew on. And if you were interested in education cases, I was to look at. And he had some generally conservative, generally for the school district. But you could say that about almost any judge, just in the things that come before them are just, you know, it's just, you know, they tend to rule for the establishment to some degree, but you know, they're one of his opinions where he just really did find the treatment of a student in a search case to be a bit appalling, and he was willing to write that, and then of course he got scrutinized heavily in his confirmation hearing over some of his special education rulings, including one in which the Supreme Court, in a different case, had really unanimously slapped down language that he had used in a case. So you know, it's too early to say, of course, about how he's going to approach things in the Supreme Court until we get some education cases. But he has established himself. You know, right away, he had one argument term last spring, and now one already this fall, where he is just intensely interested in the original meaning of a statute or of provision, and he's not afraid to write separately and give his opinion, and not afraid to, you know, get into oral argument right away. So he's not shy.
So he's much more willing to actually speak when you compare him to how quiet Justice Thomas has been in the past.
Oh yeah, I mean he's you know, he jumped into oral argument right away. There were some people said, like, oh, new justices tend to sit back. I'm not sure that was ever true or mm-hmm. not true in the modern era, but. He has not always, you know, necessarily been the first to get involved. He's sat back and waited till the end of some of the oral arguments I've seen, but you know, he's as I say, not shy about getting involved, and he hasn't been shy about last spring writing some separate concurrences, sometimes on some very peculiar or small points. So, you know, we're quite early in his, mm-hmm. you know, his time on the Supreme Court. So that they always evolve to some degree.
Mark Walsh, I want to thank you for taking your time, and I know you had just gotten back from, you know, being at the U.S. Supreme Court this morning, and hopefully we can have you back on Education Matters maybe sometime in the spring, and we can do an update on some of the cases. or certainly next June when they come up with the the actual ruling that's on some of these cases.
Absolutely, I'd be glad to do it.
Okay, and as always, thank you for everything that you write, and your contributions in the area of law.
Well, thanks, Steve. That's very kind, and I appreciate that. And always be willing to come back on and chat with you.
Okay, thanks so much. I'd like to thank my two guests this morning on Education Matters, Dr. Jack Peltz, who is assistant professor at Damon College in Amherst, New York. We talked about sleep health and start times for our public schools, and also Mark Walsh, who is a reporter who writes for Education Week and other publications, and we talked about some of the major issues right now in the area of school law. For Education Matters here on WGTD HD, I'm your host this week, Steve Brown, saying thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the 2024 Tuesdays at the Shell Concert Series is underway at Kenosha's Pennoyer Park. Free concerts every Tuesday at 6 p.m. For more info, call 262-653-4177.
I'm Gregory Berg, and on Monday's morning show here on WGTD, we're going to be hearing the story behind a new musical work called Toward Justice, which celebrates the Equal Protections Clause of the U.S. Constitution. We'll be talking with its librettist, Julia Nowicki, and with Ben Woods, who will be its narrator, as it is performed at the Civil War Museum on Tuesday evening. Also, a look back at Lincoln's second inaugural address. Monday's morning show begins just after 8.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, our Harmony Club is a nonprofit that offers respite services for caregivers. The socially oriented programs are available in the Kenosha Racine area for people with age-related challenges, including Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and social isolation. Visit ourharmonyclub.org.